Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk a little bit about some of the consequences of the post-First World War peace treaties, particularly those conducted with the Ottoman Empire. And I want to look at the causes of the destruction of the city of Smyrna. And I'm going to talk about this over a couple of episodes because looking at the destruction of Smyrna and the sort of genocidal war waged upon Christians within the Ottoman Empire is really instructive for a number of reasons. Firstly, and I'm going to be looking at an excellent book that I've read from before, The Vanquished, by Robert Gerwith. Firstly, the idea that conflict ended in 1918 is a bit of a kind of a Western-centric sort of conceit, really. Conflict in 1918 didn't end in Russia, it didn't end in the Ottoman Empire, it didn't end in Greece, it didn't end, for the most part, in Germany, and most of the most of the eastern part of Europe and the Middle East and Near Eastern parts of the world that were engulfed by the First World War continue to see endless violence. The victorious powers are the ones who are able to bring the fighting to an end in their territory. So, for example, France, Belgium, and obviously the countries like America, Great Britain, Canada, Australia, those participants who simply sent armies to Europe but didn't actually have fighting on their own territories, they, of course, are able to withdraw, for the most part, from Europe once the fighting has ended. But it's the vanquished powers, the chaos that is unleashed in the Habsburg, Ottoman, German, the Hohenzollern, and Romanov empires at the end of the war echoes on for at least another half decade. So what we're going to do today is we're going to look at the consequences of the end of the First World War for the Ottoman Empire, and particularly what the consequences were for Italy's abortive interests in acquiring Ottoman territory. So, Robert Gerwith writes, "Italy's imperial ambitions after 1918 went beyond Fiume. Fiume, obviously now in modern-day Croatia, was a city on the Dalmatian coast where there were significant numbers of ethnic Italians, and that the Italian nationalists had a long-term claim over. Later, the fascist Gabriele D'Annunzio tried to seize the city and managed to occupy it until 1920, and then was expelled. The London Treaty of 1915 had made vague promises about a just share of the Ottoman Empire for Rome, should the empire be dismantled at the end of the war. In early May 1919, to make clear that these promises had not been forgotten. Italian troops, Italians landed troops at the ports of Adalia and Marmaris in southern Anatolia, without consulting their allies. There were also rumours of in Paris of Italian vessels approaching Smyrna, the heavily Christian populated port on the western Anatolian coast that was also being claimed by Greece. Now, Italy came into the war in 1915, as mentioned, at the Treaty of London, and was promised significant spoils from the war. By the time you get to the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, the British, the French and the Americans all agree that the Italians' contribution to the war was fairly derisory, which isn't actually true in terms of lives lost and casualties endured. The Italians suffered enormously during the war in terms of actual practical contributions. They were less than glorious. But the Italians always had a sense of suspicion about the British and the French, that they wouldn't deliver on their promises. And very quickly, the Italians tried to occupy as much territory as they possibly could do in order to make sure that the facts on the ground changed. And so once the facts on the ground changed, once troops were in places in Greek islands and things like that, and parts of Anatolia, then the peacemakers, this was at the in May 1919, this was at the height of the peace conference, just as Italy was about to kind of remove itself from the peacemakers, the Supreme Allied Council. Having troops on the ground would put immense pressure, it was believed, on the peacemakers. On the 6th of May, Lloyd George said that in order to end Italy's aspirations in Asia Minor, Greece should be allowed to occupy Smyrna and all the areas around it. Woodrow Wilson, who would normally not have been very keen on imperial land grabbing, approved, he agreed, and he wanted really to show the Italian government, who were irritating him, who was boss. The Lloyd George and Woodrow Wilson both agreed that a united Yugoslavia was a much more important country to hold the Balkans together and to create a kind of a bulwark against possible Bolshevik expansion towards the Mediterranean than a larger Italy. And so they were not receptive to Italian demands for territory and very receptive to emerging of the Croat and Serbian states into a kingdom of Yugoslavia. Lloyd George summoned the Greek Prime Minister, Venizelos, to instruct him to prepare for a landing at Smyrna. Venizelos was somebody who Lloyd George admired, and Lloyd George, who liked to think in very kind of classical terms, saw this as the possible recreation of the Byzantine Empire, and this would have close links to London. It would be a kind of a greater Greece. And it's interesting that this idea of looking at classicism, much as Italian fascists did, much as Nazis did, and trying to draw lessons from antiquity and bring them into the present, that was key in some of Lloyd George's wilder imaginings. The thing about Venizelos is that he was kind of fitted the bill very neatly. He was a former Ottoman subject. He had been born in Crete in 1864 and was part of the Greek bourgeoisie that was forced to flee Crete to mainland Greece in 1886 when there was an insurrection in Crete and the Ottomans were forced out. He was, like Lloyd George, a lawyer, and had founded the Greek Liberal Party and been part of the movement for Greece to join the Allies since 1914. which had brought him into direct conflict with King Constantine I, who had been a Germanophile and had spent grown up in Germany and was married to Sophia of Prussia, who was the sister of Kaiser Wilhelm II. And as you probably may know, there's a long and complicated history between the Greek and German royal families, culminating in our very own Philip Mountbatten, the husband of Queen Elizabeth II. Constantine hadn't made any secret of his affection for Germany. He advocated neutrality for his country when hostilities began, but in defiance of this, Venizelos invited the British and French to send armies to Greece and to through the port of Salonika. And this led to Venizelos' dismissal. And in 1916, the king actually invited the Germans and Bulgarians into eastern Macedonia and Thrace, opening up Greece as a front line in the war. The Venizelos had publicly denounced the king and held a mass rally in Athens in August 1916, and two rival governments were eventually formed, a royalist rival government under Constantine and a republican government under Venizelos, and the country was divided between Athens and Salonika. Venizelos basically triumphed in this power struggle when the Allies blockaded southern Greece, which caused immense hardship and hunger for the Greeks. And Constantine was replaced in June 1917 by his younger brother Alexander, who had been the Allies' long-term choice anyway. So long before Lloyd George is instructing or encouraging Venizelos in order to seize Smyrna and to expand Greek territory and to put him directly in conflict with a revanchist, resurgent, nationalist Republic of Turkey, the British had been interfering in Greek politics in a very deep and kind of powerful way during the war, ensuring that the right kind of leaders were in place and the Germanophiles were shunted to the side and Anglophiles were brought to the front in the example of King Alexander. And this paved the way for Venizelos' ability to return to Athens and for Greece's full participation in the war against the Central Powers. So it was a great coup as far as Lloyd George was concerned. But following the victory of the Allied powers over the Central Powers, Venizelos now expected to be rewarded, much as the Italians had expected to be rewarded. And Lloyd George assured him that a Greek conquest of Smyrna would not be opposed by the other victorious states. So Venizelos had every reason to believe that he had the complete backing of the British on this subject. Robert Gerworth writes, however, Venizelos ignored the stern warning of Field Marshal Henry Wilson, who, also present at the meeting, said that the occupation of Smyrna would result in another war with an uncertain outcome, as the Turkish army was beaten but not altogether destroyed. This assessment was echoed by Lord Curzon, Arthur Balfour's right-hand man in the Foreign Office, who sent several memoranda warning the Greek Prime Minister not to underestimate the ability of Turkish troops to remobilise against an external threat. This was Turkish territory. And the Turks, who had been defeated in the First World War and seen in the post-war peace treaties their empire dismembered, were not willing to simply sit by and watch the Greeks, who they had long-standing enmity with, swallow up Ottoman territory, or former Ottoman territory.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot.
we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Turkish territory now. Wilson and Curzon, Gerwith writes, were not the only senior strategists who strongly objected to the idea of a Greek occupation of Smyrna. When Venizelos had first contemplated the idea of joining the Entente in exchange for extensive territorial gains in Anatolia in 1915, he sought the advice of Colonel Yanis Metaxas, one of the military masterminds behind Greece's success in the First Balkan War of 1912 and the country's future military dictator between 1936 and 1941. Metaxas' response was not what Venizelos had hoped for. He emphasised that the coastal areas inhabited by Ottoman Greeks were not really defensible. The envisaged occupation area contained a large numbers of Muslims who might rise up against foreign rule. While the fertile valleys of western Anatolia were dangerously exposed to any Turkish counter-attack, and from the Anatolian hinterland, any invasion could easily lead to something similar to Napoleon's disastrous campaign in Russia, as Turkish defenders would surely attempt to lure their attackers into the interior of central Anatolia with its extreme climate both in summer and winter. So Venizelos chose to ignore these warnings. Here was a politician who had been fated by the Allies, who had been encouraged by Lloyd George, and who believed he had the go-ahead and the backing of the British. Certainly Lloyd George approved of the scheme, and one of Lloyd George's abiding obsessions just throughout the First World War is a deep hatred of the Ottoman Empire, and many of his decisions were motivated by that. There was a schism in the war cabinet between those ministers and generals who referred to themselves as Westerners. They thought the war could be won on the Western Front. And there were the likes of Lloyd George and Churchill, particularly, who believed, up until 1916, that the war could be won potentially in the East by breaking the Ottoman Empire and taking a route through the Balkans, perhaps, into the heart of the Habsburg Empire. So the dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire wasn't a secondary issue for Lloyd George. This was a key war objective, and something that he viewed as kind of the work of an upstanding Christian, somebody who saw it as integral to the establishment or the rescuing of civilization. If you read Robert Fisk's amazing book, The Great War for Civilization, which is his biography of war reporting in the Middle East, he refers to title of the book refers to the medal that is the medal that his father was given at the end of the First World War. I think it's just called the Great War Medal, and on the back of it it says the Great War for Civilization, and the British use this theme of civilization, defending civilization, or defending the civilization that they had created via their empire, incessantly, that this was the motivation for the war. When you get figures during the last 5 years commemorating the First World War, particularly the British political figures saying this was a war for democracy, well, it's nothing of the sort, really. There were, and up until 1918, nobody is talking in those terms whatsoever. And the reality was that most of the soldiers who volunteered felt that they were fighting for some kind of civilization, some kind of civilized values. But, you know, you find that in recruiting stations all over Europe. So all of those who were on the winning side in 1918, Venizelos, similar to all of them, believed that a great historical opportunity to reshape the world had opened up, and reshape part of the world in Greek interests had opened up. Quite a hard-headed realist, he believed that the recreation of some Greek Mediterranean empire was possible, was within his reach. Gerwith writes, "The Megali idea, the great idea of Greek territorial expansion into Asia Minor, reuniting the mainland with the various irredentist populations under Ottoman rule, had been a prominent recurrent theme in Greek political discourse ever since the revolution of 1843, which had led to the establishment of an independent constitutional monarchy. Since then, the constant expansion of Greece's borders and the gradual assimilation of previously irredentist Greek minorities within the nation-state had created high expectations for the future inclusion of the sizable Orthodox minority within the Ottoman Empire, largely concentrated on the western and northern Anatolian coastline and its hinterland, as well as in the Pontus of the southern shore of the Black Sea." So it's fascinating, isn't it? Much of the rhetoric that Hitler comes out with up into Mein Kampf and beyond was this idea that the kind of a German diaspora scattered across Europe should be brought under one banner. Not that they should be repatriated from parts of Russia, Poland and Czechoslovakia, but German borders should expand to incorporate them and then expel or exterminate non-Germans in that area. So there seems to be something germane to nationalist figures. I'm not for a moment equating Venizelos to Hitler at all in terms of their overall outlook. But the political figures who were concerned with national rejuvenatory and national resurgence projects and imperial projects across Europe, and there are numerous examples of them, saw this idea of bringing the diaspora under one banner as a really key part of that. And it tells you perhaps something about the nature of early 20th century nationalism in that regard. So the Greek Orthodox community that stretched all the way back to the Byzantine era, to the Middle Ages, had grown sort of expansively in the 19th century, when an economic boom in and around Smyrna drew large numbers of penniless immigrants from mainland Greece and the islands of the eastern Aegean. They had travelled to Smyrna and populated it because it made economic sense to do so. Although this trend had reversed itself due to kind of tensions, ethnic tensions, in the wake of the First Balkan War, the Greek Orthodox population of Smyrna in 1914 stood at 200,000, out of a total population of 350,000. The Pontian Greeks also formed a sizable community, notably in and around the Black Sea cities of Samson, Trabzon, and they never constituted a majority in the predominantly Muslim-populated areas. So as far as Smyrna goes, there was some justification in Venizelos' eyes that seizing Smyrna made sense, that demographically it made sense, that is where there were Orthodox Greeks waiting to be liberated, and that there was some sort of justification. So just after a week after the conversation with Lloyd George on the 15th of May, Greek invasion troops arrived in Smyrna by boat, sparking excitement among the Christian population and outrage among Muslims, some of whom spontaneously founded the National Committee of Refusal of the Annexation, calling on the Turkish population to resist the invaders. So here you have this hugely tolerant city, this city that was known for its interrelated communities, that was known for the peaceful coexistence of Christians, Jews, Muslims and others, whereby the annexation of it by Greece suddenly throws divisions between those communities, suddenly starts to polarise the city and prepare it for the tragedy to come. So violence didn't take long to occur. When Greek troops marched into the city, a shot was fired on them by a Turkish refugee from Salonika, and the Greek troops responded by storming the nearby Turkish barracks, arresting soldiers inside and force marching them down towards the harbour. A procession during which the prisoners were made to go through no end of humiliation, as a Smyrna-based British businessman recalled. As one of the prisoners fell out of line, he was bayoneted to death, a murder that was followed by several others. British officers in the harbour reported that they witnessed several bodies of killed Turks being thrown into the sea. Local Greek thugs and gangs of nationalists took their cue from the behaviour of the soldiers. Recalling the suppression of Ottoman Christians during the war, they started a riot in the Turkish quarter, killing, maiming, looting and raping at will. In the chaos throughout the day, between 300 and 400 Muslim civilians and soldiers were killed. The Greek troops suffered just 2 casualties. During the imposition of martial law and the Greek military commander's public appeal to respect the personal freedom and the religious beliefs of your Muslim fellow countrymen, violence continued unabated, notably in the rural areas around the Eritrea Peninsula, where, during the war, many Christian inhabitants of the region had been deported. So we're going to finish there, and then we're going to look at the fate of Smyrna during the Greek-Turkish War that was to follow. So just to kind of focus a little bit on the kind of the theme here, what we see is that the kind of the imperial manoeuvres of the Allied powers have huge consequences, huge unforeseen consequences on the ground that generally tend to escape the notice of the main kind of historiography of the First World War, and the idea that the repercussions from the war went on and on and on. Also, again, tends to be overlooked. So this is why on this podcast I like to try to really bring these things into focus so we can talk about them. So if you are listening and enjoying, there is new exciting content on the Explaining History Patreon page. Find us on Patreon. I'm talking on Mondays about matters of current affairs in the Monday Review. And on Tuesdays, I'm uploading essay how-tos and study how-tos and kind of academic thinking how-tos to really take, if you're studying or writing history, to take what you're doing to the next level. So check us out, subscribe to Patreon, support the podcast, and there's a whole bunch of free stuff, and there'll be more to come. So thank you very much, everybody, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.